No need for fake news at the moment, is there, Bruce Shapiro? Your country is going through one of its darkest stages.
My country and my constitution both are facing probably the greatest challenge of certainly my adult lifetime. You know, we had last night in front of the White House military police flashbangs and tear gas and horses turned on entirely peaceful protesters in the backdrop of a president giving a chest-thumping denunciation of the nation's governors for being a bunch of wimps. And why were the police, military police and park police, turned on those peaceful protesters in front of the White House to clear the path so the president could do a photo op in front of an Episcopal church across the street, which had suffered fire damage the night before? A photo op holding up a Bible with a bunch of his aides.
Of course, your president is notoriously serious about his religious beliefs. I mean, that symbol of holding up the Bible, for heaven's sake, nauseous.
Well, you are not the only one nauseated. So was the bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington, which oversees the church. He essentially said the president should try opening that book instead of just holding it up. He was shocked at the abuse of his own church for this purpose and at the turning of military force against protesters. And, you know, look, the president has engaged in bellicose rhetoric before. He issues many threats that he does not follow through on. And the sort of legal jurisdiction of Washington is a little bit unique in the United States. But the reality is that with this huge national upheaval, both of revulsion at the death of Mr. Floyd in Minneapolis, captured on video, and I think the pent-up rage in a generation of young people at 4 years of unbounded presidential abuses and impunity, which we grown-ups in the room have done very little to rein in, frankly. The country is at a perilous moment, and the president has made it clear last night that if it were up to him, we would be going fully down the authoritarian path.
Over 100 cities protesting, saying that Black Lives Matter, but even at the height of the Black Lives Matter movement in 2013, 2014, it never reached these levels. What is it about the Floyd case that has made it such a potent symbol?
I think a couple of things are going on at once. First of all, in the foreground is simply the harrowing clarity of the video of Mr. Floyd's death, which I certainly have watched, and millions upon millions of Americans and millions of others around the world have watched. You know, I've covered police violence my entire career. Some of them names people know, like Abner Louima. Some of them, like a kid here in New Haven, Malik Jones, who was killed in a neighboring town after a police chase over nothing about 15 years ago, 20 years ago. But I've never seen a video that depicts so graphically the indifference of police officers, in which you see not only Officer Chauvin, who now has been fired and indicted and jailed, with his knee on the neck of a suspect, but in which there are four officers participating in this, and in which the crowd, people around, are in a very rational, polite, and calm way, intervening, pleading for Mr. Floyd's life, and saying exactly what it is that's happening, in which you can see beneath the vehicle a stream of urine flowing from the body of a dying man. That, I think, is, you know, by itself so riveting. Of course, it is coming at a time of betrayal of authority around the country by authority at a much higher level, the coronavirus pandemic, in which millions of Americans, and in particular millions of young people, are out of work, have been sent home from colleges, have lost their internships, have, in which communities of color have taken a particular overwhelming hit of coronavirus deaths. There's, you know, there's the immediate rage at impunity for police killings of people of color. There is a broader rage at the abuses of power and neglect of the public interest at the highest levels of government. And I think all of that is feeding the wave of protest that has, you know, overwhelmed cities large and small. I'm talking to you from New Haven, Connecticut, a city of 120,000 people. On Sunday, 1,000 good-spirited, boisterous, mostly young people marched through our city's downtown and then marched onto Interstate 95, one of the busiest highways in the country, and blocked it as a way of saying, enough. Business as usual is not going to go on. That's the situation we're in now.
Who are the white protesters? There's conspiracy theories galore that they're agent provocateurs.
Well, there's a few answers to that. There's no doubt that there are a few far-right groups that have longed for civil apocalypse, racial apocalypse. There's a group called the Bugle Boys in New York, and there are a few others whose members have been seen at some of the more volatile street protests, presumably egging, looting on, and, you know, this is an old story in American politics. Back in the 1960s, there were police agents and FBI agents who, turns out, fomented some of the mayhem of that period. The larger, overwhelming number of white folks who are very much part of these marches and these protests all around the country, I think are primarily a generation of young people in their 20s who have, in some cases, gone through high school, gone through university, hearing about the legacy of the civil rights movement, caring a lot about the Black Lives Matter movement, have seen police abuse and shootings of African Americans like Trayvon Martin go hardly addressed or unaddressed, have a genuine outrage about that and a genuine outrage about the lingering injustices of American society, and who now are also watching their plans, their dreams, their hopes for their own future be strangled by a president and an administration that seem not to be addressing their concerns.
Bruce, let's go back to the constitutional crisis. Could Trump really deploy the military?
Well, what he's threatened to use is an 1807 law called the Insurrection Act, which mainly acts to limit presidential power. The President of the United States is not allowed under the Constitution and under the Posse Comitatus Act to deploy the military for domestic law enforcement purposes. The exception to that is in this 1807 law, which gives governors the right or local officials the right to request federal troops, and we've seen that deployed from time to time, most recently in 1992 in Los Angeles during the Rodney King upheaval, another police violence on video upheaval. But the president normally cannot just send in the troops. The only time you can, the narrow exception in the law for that, is if local and state authorities are unwilling or unable to enforce the civil rights of citizens. So, for instance, President Eisenhower did use the Insurrection Act to authorize the use of federal troops in Arkansas for the desegregation of Little Rock High School back in the 1950s, in the early days of the Civil Rights Movement. But, you know, the nation's governors, including Republican governors, have clearly said that we are nowhere near that point. Some have requested, have, you know, deployed their National Guard. You will see a huge amount of pushback in courts and a huge amount of pushback politically if the president were to actually go through with his threat.
And yet he seems absolutely confident that this plays to his base, his appalling conduct. He seems to see this as a, in a sense, helping his presidential campaign.
His campaign is based on the agitation of a minority of voters and the demoralization of a majority. His whole, you know, division has been his political strategy and frankly, the direct invocation of violence. I mean, let's remember that his campaign really took off with the physical attack on a journalist, with the physical ejection in 2016 of Jorge Ramos, a Univision correspondent who was asking too many questions at a Trump press conference, and the president had him thrown out of the room physically. There is a direct line connecting that 2016 attack on Jorge Ramos to the impunity that police have felt over the last week around the country in attacking journalists covering these protests, something we also have not seen at such a high level, including, as I was hearing on your own news before we went to air, an Australian journalist, a seven journalist who was attacked. You know, this is the culmination of a political strategy the president has long pursued. That said, it is costing him politically. It is not a strategy that I think is actually going to win any new supporters and is attracting a wave of revulsion, even from some conservative quarters.
Bruce, thanks for that. Good to talk to you. We will, in fact, be talking to Patricia J. Williams later in the week. She's an expert on race and the criminal justice system in America.